Have you ever found yourself in a situation that's just so absurd, so unbelievably people-y that all you can do is just sort of stand there and stare?
Oh, yeah, that feeling.
That exact feeling, that moment of disbelief, you know? Maybe a little bit of theatrical exasperation. That's the gold Sebastian Maniscalco mines for his comedy.
It really is. He taps into that universal reaction we all have to the bizarre, or the inconvenient, or sometimes just the plain baffling stuff people do every single day.
Exactly. So today we're taking a deep dive into the fascinating career and the very unique comedic style of Sebastian Maniscalco.
That's great.
We've got a whole stack of your sources here: interviews, articles, biographical notes, all sorts of things. And they really trace this remarkable path he's taken.
Yeah, it's quite a journey.
It really is. Our mission today is pretty clear. We want to figure out how this kid, born in the suburbs of Chicago, who was, believe it or not, an altar
I
boy.
know, right? That detail always gets me.
Me too. How he painstakingly forged this career that took him from like gritty open mics all the way to stand-up superstardom.
And then the acting thing. That was kind of a surprise turn, wasn't it?
A huge surprise. Into this versatile acting career, big screen, small screen, you name it. We really want to unpack the key elements that make his journey and his art just so compelling.
Yeah, and I think what's really compelling, like you said, is how he carved out this incredibly distinct niche. He blends these deeply personal experiences, a lot about his family.
Right, the Italian-American experience.
Exactly. But he blends it with this universally relatable observation of modern life. It's not just simple punchlines.
No, it's more than that.
It's a whole perspective, right?
I
A
think.
stance. It's almost like this cultural lens he views everything through. So our mission today, I think, is to really understand the why. Why does he have this enduring appeal? We need to explore how those foundational experiences, his roots.
And his approach to comedy, which seems really deliberate.
Super deliberate, almost architectural, you could say, how that built a career that now spans, well, pretty much every medium you can think of. Live stage, streaming specials, Hollywood movies.
Even audio drama now, apparently.
Yeah, which is fascinating. It's just a testament to the power of having a singular, really authentic voice.
So whether you're listening and you're a longtime fan, you know, you can quote his bits word for word.
Like the doorbell bit or
Oh
the.
yeah, classic stuff. Or maybe you're just curious about what actually makes a comedian break through all the noise these days. Because let's face it, the entertainment landscape is crowded.
It really is.
Well, you're going to get some serious aha moments today, I think. This deep dive is really going to illuminate the dedication, the sheer authenticity.
And that word again, authenticity. It's key for him.
Absolutely. And the profound impact of his cultural roots, how that fueled this global career he's built.
We'll see how every little detail, you know, those early jobs, the family stuff, it all clicks together.
Yeah, like every piece was a crucial brick in building this comedic empire he has now.
It's a great illustration that sometimes the most unique voices are the ones that are deeply personal, but somehow they resonate with almost everyone.
Which is kind of the magic trick, isn't it?
It really is.
Okay, so let's start at the very beginning. Our journey into Sebastian Maniscalco's world, it really begins in the Chicago suburbs. He was born July 8th, 1973, Arlington Heights, Illinois.
Right, classic suburban Chicago.
Exactly. And here's where we get that curious detail, maybe a bit ironic, given his later career as this sharp-tongued social critic.
The altar boy thing.
The altar boy thing.
Yeah.
At just 8 years old, he was a Roman Catholic altar boy, St. Cecilia Catholic Church in Mount Prospect.
Can you just picture that? Little Sebastian, maybe 8, 9 years old, in the robes.
The cassock and surplice, yeah,
Okay.
observing everything, the rituals, the congregation, the clergy. You just know he had that keen observational gaze even then.
It almost feels like preternatural, right? Even at that age.
It does. It feels like such an unexpected starting point for a stand-up known for, let's be honest, pretty edgy observational humor sometimes.
Yeah, but you can imagine him absorbing all those subtle social cues, right? The expectations, the reverence, but also the very human, sometimes kind of absurd behaviors people have, even in a formal setting like that.
Especially in a formal setting, he's seeing it all from such a young age.
And I think that's a fantastic observation because you know, that early detail, it's way more than just a footnote in his biography. It feels foundational.
How so?
Well, think beyond just watching. Think about the psychological tension of being a kid, a silent participant in this very ritualistic environment. An 8-year-old altar boy is, well, he's a kid, but he's in this position of serves. He has to be quiet, solemn. But he's right there, seeing the whole congregation.
Seeing all their flaws and quirks, probably.
Exactly. All their very human, maybe awkward, sometimes even hypocritical behaviors. He's seeing it all.
So he's not just watching. He's kind of internalizing it.
Right. He's internalizing the performative side of how people interact, but he can't react outwardly. He can't comment.
That makes sense, that tension.
That tension.
Yeah.
Between the expected reverence and what he's actually seeing, that could very well be the root of his later comedic persona, that sort of bewildered outrage, or even his physical comedy.
The way he contorts his face, yeah.
Yeah. He spent years literally standing still, watching, internalizing. Those are invaluable skills for an observational comedian.
So it's like early training.
In a way, yeah. His subjects later on, marriage, social interactions, pop culture, they all hinge on this really close, almost anthropological examination of nuances.
Like he was doing during Mass back then.
Precisely. It teaches you to really see the world, often through this filter of internal judgment or maybe just confusion. And that becomes his comedic gold.
Wow. Okay. And after the altar boy stint?
Well, he continued his formative years there, went to Rolling Meadows High School. Mm. So that really cements that suburban Chicago upbringing, which gave him such a rich, relatable canvas for his comedy later.
Right. That relatable, everyday guy foundation. So it wasn't just the setting. It was the role he played within that setting. Observation, internal processing.
Exactly. And speaking of foundations, we absolutely have to talk about his heritage. This is huge.
The Italian-American roots. For a lot of people, this is his comedy.
It's the heart and soul, right? He's the son of Italian immigrants. His father, Salvatore Maniscalco, was a hairstylist. Immigrated from Cefalù, Sicily, when he was just 15.
15, that's so young.
Incredible, isn't it?
Oh.
And his mother, Rose Maniscalco, she worked as a secretary. Her family also has deep roots in Naples, Campania, and other parts of Sicily.
So this isn't just like background info for him.
Not at all. It's the profound, inexhaustible wellspring of his comedic voice. He's known for that nostalgia type of humor, people call it.
Mm-hmm. Grounded in family.
Deeply grounded in his personal family experiences, especially being raised in what he calls an old school environment with an immigrant father.
You can almost picture those dinner table conversations, can't you?
Totally. The generational clashes, the traditional values. And now he shares those stories with millions, turning them into these universally relatable bits about culture, identity, and just how weird modern life can seem.
Yeah, comparing the old ways to now.
And that's precisely where all those observational seeds we talked about really blossomed. His Italian-American heritage. It's not just a detail, it's the lens.
The lens he sees the world through.
Exactly. It creates that iconic fish out of water perspective that really defines his comedy. Imagine his dad, Salvatore, arriving from Sicily at 15.
Right, a whole different culture.
Totally different. Steeped in tradition, directness, a certain, you know, no-nonsense pragmatism, and then raising a family in suburban America.
So Sebastian grew up navigating both worlds.
Essentially bilingual, yeah. Not just language, but cultural codes. He's constantly doing this kind of mental translation, comparing modern American behaviors to the straightforward, maybe minimalist expectations he grew up with.
Which leads directly to the, can you believe this?
Precisely. That dual perspective fuels it. He's not just observing. He's processing through two different cultural filters and highlighting that often hilarious disconnect.
It's an endless source of material.
Inexhaustible. It gives him this unique contrast between old world ways and, well, us now.
Right.
When he sees people being overly polite or convoluted or obsessed with technology,
yeah,
he's seeing it with his father's voice in his head, you know.
Yeah, why you do that?
Exactly. Or the traditional expectations from his mother's side. And even the specifics, like his dad being a hairstylist, his mom a secretary.
How does that play in?
Well, those are jobs that involve constant, often intimate interaction with people. You're observing social dynamics, personal quirks, up close, all day long.
Ah, so maybe he picked up some observational skills from them, too.
Absolutely. Those skills were undoubtedly part of his environment, passed down, further honing what was already there.
Okay, so we have this incredibly rich cultural background, this dual lens view of the world. And then, maybe surprisingly for some, he goes the formal education route. Graduates from Northern Illinois University in 1995.
Yep, NIU.
With a degree in communication studies. And not just that, he was president of his fraternity chapter, Sigma Pi.
Right, leader of the pack.
So how do those experiences, focusing on persuasion, public speaking, group dynamics, How does that mesh with the raw, often chaotic, personal world of stand-up comedy?
It seems counterintuitive at first, maybe.
A little bit, but you can almost see the pieces fitting together, right? Yeah. Someone who's going to stand on stage and talk about how we communicate.
Or fail to communicate, yeah. Which is a lot of his comedy.
Exactly. How spectacularly we fail.
Yeah, it's a fantastic point because on the surface, a comms degree and frat leadership might seem, I don't know, almost opposite to the unpredictable vibe of comedy. But actually, they're incredibly complementary.
How so? Tell me more.
Well, a communications degree isn't just about giving speeches, right? It's about decoding human interaction, understanding nonverbal cues, mastering rhetoric, crafting a message that connects with a specific audience.
Okay, all crucial for a comedian.
Fundamental tools. He would have learned about audience analysis, the art of storytelling, how to tailor a message, skills you absolutely need if you want universal appeal while drawing from super personal stuff.
And the fraternity president role.
That's like a hands-on masterclass in reading a room. Managing different personalities, handling conflicts, turning group chaos into something cohesive.
Yeah, okay, I see that.
He's organizing events, motivating people, giving speeches, all things that translate directly to commanding a stage and an audience.
So it provided the theory and the practice.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The theoretical framework from the degree and the practical application from the fraternity. It's all about understanding how to connect, how to lead an audience through a story. How to get everyone nodding along at the absurdities he sees.
Even if he didn't realize it at the time, it was preparing him.
Preparing him, maybe unconsciously, yeah. For the very specific demands of standing up there alone and making thousands of strangers feel like they're in on the joke with him, delivering those raw observations with precision and maximum impact.
Okay, so with that foundation, the cultural roots, the academic prep, if you will, now we jump ahead, we get to what so many comedians call the grind.
Oh, yeah. The L.A. years.
Those years of just relentless effort in Los Angeles, it really defines his whole earning it philosophy, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Comedy isn't learned, it's earned. That's his mantra.
He moves to L.A. in 1998, throws himself right into the fire, the open mic circuit.
And that scene is rough.
Oh, notoriously unforgiving, right? Dimly lit bars, back rooms of bowling alleys, places where you probably learn more about bombing than soaring.
Definitely builds character. Or breaks you.
Right. Where the audience might be way more interested in their beer or the game than your carefully crafted jokes. And he wasn't just doing that.
No, he had the day job or night job.
The night job. Working as a waiter at the Four Seasons Hotel in Beverly Hills, no less.
Talk about pressure.
From 1998 to 2005, 7 years, serving the elite, the demanding, the often oblivious clientele you find there. That's a brutal double life.
It really is.
So what did those nearly 7 years grinding in open mics, serving the wealthy, what did that actually teach him about human behavior, about comedy?
Well, that's a crucial question, isn't it? Because those 7 years at the Four Seasons, observing people at their most demanding, maybe their most revealing, that was nothing short of a real-world PhD in human behavior.
Directly feeding the comedy.
Directly feeding his observational style. Think about it. A high-end place like the Four Seasons. He saw an incredible range of personalities.
The good, the bad, and the ugly, probably.
From the genuinely nice to the incredibly entitled, yeah. Often wrapped up in that sort of forced politeness, it gave him direct, unfiltered access to the outlandish behavior he talks about so much.
He wasn't just seeing what people do, but how they do it.
Exactly. The little gestures, the tone of voice, the unspoken expectations, the whole performative aspect of social interaction.
That's why his stuff feels so real, even when it's exaggerated.
Right. Because the core behaviors are painfully recognizable. We've all seen versions of those people.
And the open mics, that part of the grind.
Well, the open mics, where you fail way more than you succeed, combined with the demanding waiter job. That just builds incredible resilience and a deep understanding that getting good takes relentless work, constant refinement.
You got to earn it.
You got to earn it. So the fact that he eventually started performing regularly at the Comedy Store in West Hollywood around 2005, that's a huge pivot point.
Yeah, that's a legendary club.
It signals that his craft was really solidifying. The industry was noticing. He developed something truly unique. He wasn't just, you know, telling jokes anymore. He was presenting these fully formed characters and scenarios based on all those hard-earned observations, ready for a bigger stage.
And this is where we really see that signature style come into focus, right? That can you believe this thing? That sort of aghast, exasperated reaction to modern life.
Yeah, it becomes unmistakable.
But it didn't just appear overnight, did it? You mentioned it took him almost 2 decades to really hone that.
Right, that's what he says. It was constant work.
He uses that great analogy, fleshing out your joke, your bit, like a bodybuilder sculpting their physique.
Yeah, I love that quote.
He says, and this is so telling, you don't become a bodybuilder the first day you start lifting weights. Same thing with comedy. You gotta flesh out your jerk, your bit. You add and subtract. You see what works.
It really speaks to how deliberate he is. It's iterative. It's a craft.
It really is. Mm. And he's known for those heavy physical and verbal variations in his delivery. They bring his observations to life so vividly.
The physicality is huge for him.
Huge. He riffs on his immigrant father, obviously, which we talked about, but also just broadly on his sheer amazement at people's outlandish behavior. That astonishment is his signature.
It totally is.
And then you look at his influences. It's a fascinating list. Jerry Seinfeld, obviously. George Carlin. Mm-hmm. Brian Regan. But also John Ritter. And Johnny Carson. Andrew Dice Clay. Bill Burr. Don Rickles.
Wow, that's a real mix, isn't it?
It's an incredible lineage. From pure observation to biting social commentary to physical comedy to sheer attitude. How do all those different voices kind of merge into the Maniscalco style we recognize today?
Well, that's where the artistry really comes in, isn't it? And it goes right back to his philosophy. Comedy isn't learned, it's earned.
Right.
From Seinfeld, you absolutely see that meticulous, almost microscopic focus on the absurdities of everyday life.
Yeah.
You know, a classic Seinfeld bit about waiting in line or something.
Yeah.
Maniscalco applies that same sharp lens, but... and this is crucial, he filters it through his Italian-American old-school sensibility.
So it's observation plus cultural commentary.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Seinfeld might just observe the weirdness of small talk. Maniscalco physically recoils and asks, why would you even try to make small talk when there's nothing real to say?
Yeah, okay. What about Carlin?
The Carlin influence, I think, is less about the politics and more about that deep-seated, almost intellectual frustration with how illogical society can be.
Like his bits about self-checkout or complicated coffee orders.
Totally. They have that same exasperated critical tone, like a cultural anthropologist who's just had enough.
And Rickles. That seems like a strong influence, too.
Undeniable. That fearless, no-holds-barred delivery. There's an edge there, a playful challenge to the audience. You lean in, even if you're a little uncomfortable, because you know it's coming from genuine observation.
Okay, but John Ritter, that one seems different.
It does. But think about Maniscalco's physical comedy, his exaggerated faces, the rapid-fire gestures. They aren't just tacked on.
No, they're part of the joke.
They're as integral as the words. He paints this vivid picture that goes beyond language, much like Ritter can tell a whole story with just a physical ectic or a movement. He's not just describing the absurdity, he's performing it with his entire body.
The bewilderment, the outrage.
All of it. So pulling all those influences together lets him take these super personal stories and make them feel like universal moments of collective head shaking. Makes his specific worldview feel really accessible.
Okay, now let's talk about the big leagues. The real markers of a comedian making it. The hour-long specials.
Right, the specials are huge milestones.
His progression here really tracks his rise in popularity, his move to global recognition. It started, like for many, with a half hour on Comedy Central Presents.
Which is a critical early step, yeah. Gets your name out there.
A national calling card, basically. But he didn't stop there. He goes on to release five hour-long specials, each one building on the last.
Shows real growth.
We got Sebastian Live back in 2009. Then What's Wrong with People? In 2012, that was on Showtime, a longer, more developed set.
Showtime is a big platform then.
Definitely. Followed by Aren't You Embarrassed in 2014, also Showtime, and that one was taped in Chicago. Kind of bringing it back home.
Nice touch. Must have been great energy there.
You can feel it. Then why would you do that? In 2016, again, Showtime, but taped in New York City this time, capturing that energy.
Yeah.
But the really game-changing jump, I think, was Stay Hungry, released on Netflix in 2019.
Ah, the Netflix effect.
Totally. Massive global platform, algorithm pushing it out everywhere. Then his most recent one, Is It Me?, also hit Netflix in 2022, cementing that streaming dominance.
He became a fixture on there.
And looking ahead, we already know there's another one coming. It ain't right. It's slated for Hulu in 2026, so he's staying in the streaming game.
Yeah, and if we zoom out a bit, the significance of moving through those platforms, Comedy Central, Showtime, then the giants like Netflix and Hulu, that's just his career path. It really mirrors how stand-up itself has changed in the digital age.
How so?
Well, that Comedy Central half hour. Great start, but mostly a taste for cable viewers, an industry calling card. Showtime gave him the crucial hour format.
Let him build a real narrative.
Exactly. Craft a more complete artistic statement. Callbacks, character stuff, appealing to a more dedicated audience, maybe slightly more discerning.
But Netflix.
Netflix in 2019 was a seismic shift. It wasn't just more eyeballs, it was different eyeballs and this new kind of global reach.
The algorithm effect you mentioned.
Right. It let Maniscalco's super specific, culturally rooted humor break through traditional boundaries, geographic, demographic. It proved universal truths can hide in really particular experiences.
Took him from successful club comic to global streaming star almost overnight.
Pretty much. And the upcoming Hulu special, It Ain't Right, just solidifies his presence across the major streamers, ensuring he keeps reaching that vast, diverse audience.
And even the titles, right? What's wrong with people? Hey, aren't you embarrassed? Why would you do that? Is it me?
They perfectly capture that whole observational, slightly exasperated persona, don't they? Like a progression of his frustration with the world.
But his expansion wasn't just about the specials, was it? He was branching out much earlier.
Yeah, diversifying his reach.
He was one of the four comics featured in Vince Vaughn's Wild West comedy show. Remember that? The documentary tour thing?
Oh yeah, 30 Days and 30 Nights. That was a cool project.
It really was. It let him show off his style to live audiences all over the country, outside the usual big city comedy clubs.
Took him to different crowds.
And critically, he became a regular face on basically every major late night show.
You couldn't miss him for a while there.
Seriously. Craig Ferguson, Leno Both Tonight Show, and the Jay Leno Show, Fallon, Conan, Colbert, all of them.
That's a murderer's row of late night.
It really is. And that wasn't just about telling jokes in a TV studio. It was about building a national profile, right? Giving millions of viewers these short, high-impact bursts of that Maniscalco energy.
Kind of prepping them for bigger things.
Exactly. Yeah. Getting him ready for film and TV roles. Those spots are so vital for comedians. Short set, huge audience, maybe seeing you for the first time.
High pressure, high reward.
You got to grab their attention instantly, showcase your best stuff, make an impression, paving the way for everything that came next.
Yeah, it's compelling how those early things, the Vince Vaughn tour, the constant late night gigs, were absolutely crucial for broadening his exposure. Showcasing that stage presence to way more people.
Sharpening his skills under pressure.
Definitely. Each late night spot is like a 5-minute audition for millions. You have to connect instantly, deliver with precision. It demands engagement right out of the gate.
So those experiences absolutely sharpened his performance chops, taught him how to distill his essence into these tight, impactful segments.
Effectively served as the stepping stone, yeah.
Yeah.
Prepared him for the different demands of acting by making his face, his voice, familiar to a huge audience. And proving he could deliver under pressure.
So he wasn't just some random comedian showing up in movies later. People already knew him.
Exactly. He built that loyal following and showed his versatility long before the big acting roles landed. He could enter those new arenas with a recognized persona and a proven ability to grab an audience.
And then came the acting roles themselves, which for a stand-up can be a really tricky transition, right?
Notoriously difficult. The skill sets don't always translate directly.
But Sebastian seems to have navigated it brilliantly. He really made a mark. His feature film debut was The House in 2017. And appropriately enough,
he played a stand-up comic.
He played a stand-up comic, easing him in. But from there, he started exploring a really diverse range of stuff.
Yeah, he didn't just stick to playing versions of himself.
No. He did voice work Johnny in The Nut Job 2. Nutty by nature, which is a whole different skill set, right? Conveying character just with your voice, your cadence.
Leveraging that distinctive delivery.
Totally. He was also in Cruise as DiNardo and played a pastor in Tag. Remember Tag?
Vaguely, yeah.
Yeah.
Ensemble comedy.
So these early roles, from voice acting to supporting parts, showed he was willing to explore different sides of performing beyond just his own stand-up material.
Shows adaptability. A desire to expand his creative canvas.
It's one thing to play yourself or someone close to your persona. It's another to inhabit animated characters or specific roles in an ensemble. It takes a different kind of discipline.
Yeah, a deeper dive into the collaborative craft of acting.
Right.
And a key insight here is how his acting career started with this really thoughtful, almost strategic expansion, not just a sudden jump.
Starting with the stand-up role in The House.
Exactly. Leveraged his existing persona, eased him into the film world. But then the voice work in Nut Job 2, the other varied, live action roles.
Yeah.
It shows this gradual, deliberate exploration of the craft.
Which raises the question, right? How does stand-up prepare you for film acting? They seem so different.
They are different. In stand-up, you're everything.
Mm.
Writer, director, performer. Total control. Holding the audience alone.
Film is collaborative. Hitting marks, saying other people's lines.
Blending into an ensemble, exactly. But his stand-up background, especially that mastery of physical comedy, the precise timing, conveying emotion with just a look that actually translates really well to the camera.
He understands pacing, emotional beats.
And how to convey a lot without being fussy, which is vital on film. And the voice acting capitalized on his unique vocal delivery, proving his voice itself was a transferable asset.
So those early roles showed he was willing to learn and adapt.
Which was absolutely crucial for the bigger, more acclaimed roles that were coming up next.
Okay, let's get to those. Because this is a pivotal part of his acting story, a really fascinating dimension that showed his dramatic range.
Yeah, this is where it gets really interesting.
I mean, imagine going from stand-up clubs to sharing the screen with absolute legends, Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, Al Pacino, in a Martin Scorsese film.
The Irishman. Iconic.
But even before that, he had a significant role as Johnny Veneer in Green Book. 2018.
Academy Award winner for Best Picture.
Exactly. That's already a massive step for any actor, let alone a comedian, primarily. Being part of a film that gets that level of critical acclaim, Oscar buzz.
Puts you in a different category.
For sure. Then, 2019, he takes on Crazy Joe Gallo in Scorsese's The Irishman.
A real historical figure.
A mobster.
And not just a cameo, it's a proper role, holding his own alongside those titans.
That takes guts. And skill.
And not only was he in the film, but he hosted the companion podcast for it, Behind the Irishman. Three parts, came out December 2019.
Oh, I didn't know about the podcast. Yeah. It shows this deeper involvement, right? Using his natural audio talent to give us behind-the-scenes insight, almost like a comedian commentating on this serious cinematic masterpiece.
That's cool, blending his worlds.
These roles, Green Book and The Irishman, they're huge milestones. They showcase serious dramatic range, prove he could hang with the best. Far more than just comedic timing.
Yeah, the genius really is how he made that leap, not just in projects, but in the depth of the roles. Johnny Veneer in an Oscar winner, then Crazy Joe Gallo for Scorsese, alongside De Niro, Pesci, Pacino. That's a profound validation of his acting chops, not just his fame.
It's not just the comedian who can also act.
No. It's demonstrating dramatic range few comedians ever reach. Playing Jay Gallo, a complex, real-life mob figure, requires intensity, menace, maybe some vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Totally different from his usual bewildered stand-up persona.
So how does he do it? How does someone known for that specific comedic voice pull off these serious, character-driven roles so well?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I think it suggests a deeper understanding of human nature, of motivation, stuff he probably honed through decades of observing and dissecting behavior for his comedy. Now he's translating those insights into authentic character portrayals.
Using the same observational skills, but for drama instead of laughs.
Kind of, yeah. And hosting the Behind the Irishman podcast.
Mm-hmm.
That shows his intellectual engagement with the material, his ability to analyze storytelling, blending his conversational style with a more critical documentary approach.
It really demonstrates his versatility across different formats, adapting his unique voice to serve different artistic visions way beyond just comedy.
Absolutely. It highlights an ability to adapt while still somehow being himself.
And he definitely didn't stop there, did he? He just kept expanding, embracing the full multi-hyphenate career thing.
He really leaned into it.
That distinct voice kept leading to more voice acting. We heard him as Spike, Mario, and Luigi's boss in the Super Mario Bros. Movie. Huge hit in 2023.
His voice fit that perfectly. Gruff, but funny.
Totally. And he's voicing Magician Mouse in IF coming up in 2024. But maybe the most personal project and really intriguing is that 2023 film about my father.
Right. The one with De Niro playing his dad.
Yeah. He co-wrote it, co-starred in it. And it's loosely based on his own life, his relationship with his immigrant father.
Bringing it full circle.
Completely full circle. Bringing his core comedy themes right onto the big screen and collaborating with De Niro, who's played so many iconic Italian-American dads himself. It's kind of perfect casting.
Yeah, it really is. A legend playing his legendary dad, basically.
He also starred as Frank Russo in Somewhere in Queens in 2022, and he's going to be Chester Slink in Unfrosted in 2024.
Busy guy.
Unbelievably busy.
Yeah.
And as if all that wasn't enough, remember he hosted the MTV Video Music Awards back in 2019?
Oh, yeah. That's a tough gig. Live TV, unpredictable crowd.
Totally. Shows incredible comfort in that live, unscripted, high-pressure zone, way different from a controlled film set or even a stand-up special. Requires serious, quick-wit improvisation.
Proof he's just a natural entertainer.
Absolutely. Not just an actor, not just a comedian. An entertainer in the broadest sense.
And connecting it back to his career arc. About my father. Really is that remarkable full circle moment, isn't it? Taking the immigrant father humor that defined his stand-up and weaving it into a narrative film.
With De Niro as his dad.
With De Niro embodying that figure. It's this fascinating blend of autobiography and art, showing he can translate his voice and his life story across mediums and do it with a master like De Niro.
It solidifies him as a storyteller with a real point of view.
Definitely. Rooted in his heritage. And the voice acting roles, like Spike and Mario, show how his unique vocal quality is becoming its own recognizable brand. He can bring character just through sound.
His voice is his signature in many ways.
It is. And hosting the VMAs, that's another layer. Needs crazy quick wit, adaptability, engaging a diverse, maybe rowdy live audience. Skills owned perfectly by years of stand-up.
It all feeds into each other.
It really does. It showcases his total entertainment value. He can pivot from observation to drama, voice work, to writing, hosting, all with proficiency. It underscores his evolution into this incredibly versatile, multi-hyphenate talent who connects with audiences in so many ways.
So what does all this mean for his overall media presence? I mean, it's undeniable now. Sebastian Maniscalco isn't just a stand-up anymore. He's a brand, a presence across multiple platforms, especially TV, where he's really made some significant moves.
Yeah, he's become a fixture there, too.
We can trace scripted appearances way back to Complete Savages in 2004. Later, he showed up as himself in the Comedy Store docuseries in 2020, which felt fitting.
Giving back to the place that launched him, in a way.
Exactly. But his move into reality and unscripted TV is really insightful, I think. He hosted Well Done with Sebastian Maniscalco on Discovery Plus, premiered August 2021.
The food show. I remember that.
Yeah. It totally leaned into his established persona, right? Exploring food culture, etiquette, often with his own family and friends.
Very on brand for him. The old school guy reacting to modern food trends.
Totally. It was such a hit, resonated with people who liked his take on modern dining, that they renewed it really fast for a second season. Came out just a few months later, November 2021.
Makes sense. It's a natural extension of his humor, applied to food and social rituals. More bewilderment.
Right. And then on the scripted side, he starred for two seasons as Danny in Bookie, debuted November 2023. And importantly, he was also an executive producer on that.
Oh, getting involved behind the scenes more.
Yeah, shows deeper involvement, shaping the narrative, not just performing. And just to round out his TV presence, he even popped up on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire in 2024.
Huh. Okay, covering all the bases.
Seriously. He's building this diverse empire, all based on that singular comedic voice, just finding new ways to connect.
And it raises that question again.
Yeah.
How does that move into reality TV? Like, Well Done. Leverage his specific persona so effectively.
Seems like a perfect fit.
It really is. The food show directly taps into his core themes, absurdity of modern norms, his old school Italian-American view, often contrasting it with his actual family and friends right there on screen.
Makes the observational stuff feel very immediate.
Exactly. It's unscripted, which naturally amplifies his observational skills and that signature bewildered reaction. Smart way to broaden his appeal without watering down his voice at all.
And starring in and producing Bookie.
That signals his expanding influence behind the camera. A clear desire to shape the creative direction, build narratives that fit his sensibilities, his timing. It's not just taking acting jobs anymore.
It's strategic expansion.
Definitely. Strategic expansions of his brand, exploring different facets of entertainment, while staying totally true to the comedic and cultural roots that define him. Even the millionaire appearance speaks to that broad public recognition, showing his charm works outside of comedy, too.
And beyond the visual stuff, TV, movies, he's also made a huge, lasting impact in the audio world, which is so important now for connecting directly with audiences.
Podcasts are key for that direct relationship.
He's got a long-running one. The Pete and Sebastian Show with Pete Coriale.
Yeah, they've been doing that for ages.
It's not just a casual thing, either. It's consistent. Since January 2017, they've even had a show on SiriusXM's Raw Dog comedy channel, wider reach again.
Gives fans that regular dose.
Right. It allows for this direct, less structured conversation, more intimate, more conversational than a polished special. Listeners get a deeper sense of his personality, his unedited thoughts, everyday stuff.
Builds that connection.
Absolutely. Yeah. He also did Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee back in 2016, which felt like a nod to his influences, right? That candid chat with Seinfeld about The Craft.
Joining the comedy elite in that format.
But here's the really intriguing new direction. Apple's first ever scripted podcast, announced April 23, 2025. It's called Easy Money, the Charles Ponzi story.
Okay.
And Maniscalco is voicing Charles Ponzi.
Wow. Ponzi himself. That's a departure.
Huge departure. The podcast discusses Ponzi's rise and fall, his schemes, hosted by Maya Lau. But Maniscalco as Ponzi, that's a serious dramatic audio role.
That really makes you ask, doesn't it? What does this move into scripted podcasting, voicing a historical dramatic figure like Ponzi for Apple? What does that signify for an artist known mostly for observational comedy?
It feels like a big statement.
It suggests profound adaptability, yeah. A recognition that he can fully inhabit characters, not just play versions of himself. It's a huge testament to his vocal acting talent and the power of pure audio storytelling. Expands his reach beyond visuals again.
His stand-up always had those character voices, the mimicry.
Right, a strong audio component.
Yeah.
But playing Ponzi, that needs a totally different approach. Deep dive into character psychology, nuanced narrative performance, all without visual cues.
It's pure acting through voice.
Exactly. And the long-running Pete and Sebastian show already proved his skill in sustained audio engagement, building that almost familial relationship with listeners. Comedians in Cars put him in the pantheon conversationally.
But the Apple podcast feels different. Bolder.
It's a bold strategic leap.
Yeah.
It hints at a future where his voice is recognized not just for laughs, but for dramatic range, compelling storytelling, powerful expansion into new territory. Shows an artist who's not going to be boxed in, always growing.
And through all of this, the career building, the constant evolution, he's also built this vibrant personal life, which you have to assume keeps feeding the comedy.
Life becomes the material, right?
Exactly. He married Lana Gomez back in August 2013. They have two kids now. Daughter Serafina Simone, born 2017, and son Caruso Jack, born 2019.
Little Sebastian Jr. is running around.
Can't you just hear the future bits already? The hilarious struggles of parenthood, the absurdities of modern family life, navigating marriage. It's all just more grist for his comedic mill.
Keeps the material fresh and relatable.
Totally. His personal life, being a husband, becoming a father, it flows right into the everyday life and marriage stuff in his comedy, constantly refreshing it, expanding it, keeps it authentic for audiences who might be going through similar things.
It's the ultimate proof for him. Life is the material. Observed through that uniquely Italian-American, perpetually bewildered lens.
So wrapping this up, when you look at his whole career,
it's really compelling how his entire career just highlights the value of authenticity and that relentless self-refinement.
From those deep Italian-American roots, that old-school environment.
To the grind of open mics and waiting tables. He has consistently, almost stubbornly, drawn from his own life, his own observations.
Never straying from that core, can you believe this perspective, which everyone recognizes now.
Everyone. And his evolution, stand-up, acclaimed film actor, voice artist, TV host, producer, author, now dramatic audio actor, it shows incredible adaptability across so many different media.
Yet somehow he stays true to that unique voice.
Exactly. He makes the most specific cultural stuff feel universal. It's a powerful testament to having a distinct, authentic perspective, meticulously honed, passionately delivered.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? I think Sebastian Maniscalco's story is this vivid reminder, really, that sometimes the best insights, the funniest humor, it just comes from paying attention.
Truly seeing the world, not just looking at it.
Yeah. His journey shows that dedication, connecting to your roots, committing to your craft, it can take you from humble beginnings, like being an altar boy in Illinois,
to the absolute global stage.
It really makes you wonder, doesn't it? What unexpected observations are you making in your own life right now? What mundane or frustrating moments are you seeing that could spark a story or a deep dive or even just a shared laugh with someone?
That bewildered head shake we all recognize.
Exactly. It's a powerful call to just observe, engage, and maybe embrace the humor and the humanity and the everyday stuff around us.